Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is the Nordic Asia Podcast.
Welcome to the Nordic Asia Podcast, a collaboration sharing expertise on Asia across the Nordic region. My name is Kenneth Bo-Nielsen. I'm a social anthropologist based in Oslo and also one of the leaders of the Norwegian Network for Asian Studies. As we speak, the Indian national elections are underway. This year, in 2024, a record number of Indian voters can cast their vote, as close to 1 billion Indians are now eligible to vote. This makes the ongoing elections the biggest democratic exercise in world history. In popular discourse, India is often spoken about as the world's largest democracy. And the current Indian government, led by Prime Minister Modi, even speaks of India as the mother of democracy. But there are also a few, or quite many perhaps, indications that things are not as rosy. The most recent report from the VDEM Institute that monitors the state of democracy on a global scale classifies India as an autocratizing country and as an electoral autocracy. This decline of democracy in India has included a substantial deterioration of freedom of expression, compromising the independence of the media, crackdowns on social media, harassments of journalists critical of the government, as well as attacks on civil society and intimidation of the opposition. In other words, much is at stake when India votes in 2024. To discuss the elections and their possible outcomes, we are joined today by two seasoned India researchers from the University of Oslo and also two very good friends, Arild Engelsen Root and Francesca Jansenius. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Thank you.
So, as we heard, close to 1 billion voters. I checked, and this is more than six times as many voters as are normally registered for a US presidential election. Six times as many. Indeed, the number of eligible voters in just a single Indian state, the state of Uttar Pradesh, is roughly equal to the total number of voters who will register to vote for either Biden or Trump this fall. Of course, making a US presidential election look like quite a provincial affair. The election in India is stretched out across three calendar months. It started already last week on 19 April. And is now unfolding in seven phases, with the last and final voting day scheduled for 1st June. Arild Engelsen Root, this is a massive exercise, but just how massive is an Indian election in practice?
In practice, it's enormous. There's 1 million polling stations. 1 million polling stations. There are 15 million officials mobilized to work as election officials. As you said, there's close to 1 billion people registered to vote. Turnout is also normally quite high, between 60 and 70%, so it's quite good. The number of voters is, you know, more than those who voted in other elections or are going to vote in other elections this year. So Indonesia, US, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Russia, Mexico, South Africa, all put together have fewer voters than India. So it's enormous. It's also enormous in certain other respects. One is, of course, that estimates suggest that as much as $14 billion will be spent on the elections. That's an enormous sum, probably twice as much as the last national election in India. The 2,600 political parties registered. The interesting thing is with the constituencies, because these constituencies are quite large. There's about 2.2 million citizens per constituency. So in Norway, there would be two representatives, two electorates, right, or two constituencies. These constituencies do vary from about 300, the smallest one is about 300,000 citizens. The larger ones have well over 2.5 million people. Interestingly, the larger ones are in the more populous states and the smaller ones are in the very small states, in particular in the Northeast. So they are overrepresented in parliament. and also tiny places like Goa, Pondicherry, Andamans, Lakshadweep, and others overrepresented. But an enormous exercise, and a fabulous one. Very interesting.
We've covered Indian politics quite frequently in many episodes over the past years in this podcast series. And almost regardless of the theme we've discussed, among the conclusions have been that Modi and the BJP, his party, are moving from strength to strength. This has been more or less the narrative for the past 10 years or so. Two massive wins in 2014, 2019, and now eyes firmly set on a third successive win, something that also virtually all opinion polls predict will happen. So if we look at Indian elections across this long history back to 1947, it seems as if there's now a tectonic shift from an era of the past where the Congress was the dominant party and to a new system now where we have the BJP as the totally dominant party in terms of elections. Francesca, is this a correct reading of what's going on in Indian politics now?
I think that is indeed a correct reading. We often talk of the Congress era of Indian politics, where the Congress party was the main game in town and dominated the elections, and where the opposition was always in competition with the Congress party. In the 80s, that dominance clearly disappeared, and you saw a fragmented party system where we thought that no single party could win majorities. But in the 90s, BJP has been slowly increasing their support until they managed to win the election in 2014 and then with an even larger majority in 2019. So in terms of party system, it's definitely a shift from a one-party dominant system with the Congress as the main party to a one-party dominant system with the BJP as the dominant party. At the same time, if we look at voting patterns across this entire period, if you look at the aggregated level, at the national level, it looks like these parties are very dominant. But in terms of voting patterns, if you look at the constituency level, they are actually not that dominant. And this is due to a high degree of fragmentation in voting in India. Due to the electoral system, the first-past-the-post systems, party can win seats even if they have much less than 50% of the vote. And throughout India's history, you have seen some MPs winning their seat with much less than 50% of the vote, although close to 50% win shares have been sort of the average across the country, across this entire period. But there is a lot of fragmentation. Often there is one party that gets a large share of the vote, but the rest of the vote is split between several parties. And across India, we see that if the opposition had managed to coordinate either at the elite level or at the voter level, a lot of outcomes in the elections would have looked very, very different. We also see a high degree of volatility. So vote shifts from one election to the other in Indian elections. India is known at the national level for high levels of volatility, which is measured as whether the same or different parties get votes across elections. But even if you look at the micro level in villages, in polling stations, you see that often there are massive vote swings from one party to the next across elections. And so parties can really not be very certain of their own electoral victory. They have to work very hard on many fronts to string together winning coalitions in most constituencies. I also think it's important to bear in mind when looking at these aggregate level outcomes where parties look very dominant, that as Aril said, you have a high turnout in India for a democracy, between 60 and 70%. Historically, it's been on average about around 60. And in the last two elections, we saw higher shares. In 2019, it was 67%. But that still means that a large share of registered voters do not cast their vote. So we shouldn't forget all the people who are not voting when we interpret these election results. And indeed, looking at micro-level data, village and town-level data, BJP managed to win big in 2014 and 2019 to a large extent because they managed to get out the vote, because they managed to increase turnout, and particularly in urban areas. That's in the big cities is where the BJP seems to have been really able to get out the vote and shift elections.
So much more volatility beneath what looks like sort of an overall macro trend. And this introduces, of course, an element of uncertainty and maybe also encourages a bit of optimism among the opposition parties. But still, I mean, I think we can say that moving into this election, Modi looks to be the clear favorite because he is an incredibly popular prime minister, no? which is, I mean, in some ways a bit paradoxical, because as we know, and as I mentioned in the beginning, under his rule, virtually all these global democracy indexes, they show that Indian democracy is deteriorating, that the country now ranks among the top autocratizers in the world with a narrowing space for public debate, and not least where the civil rights and liberties of minorities are severely undermined. There are even some doubts about how well the Indian economy is actually doing, and that it might be doing a lot less well than what Modi's government and its statistics claim. So in theory, one can think of very many reasons why Modi might be on a weak wicket after 10 years in power, but he isn't. He seems to be hugely popular. Ariel, what are we to make of this?
Well, that's a good question. If only we knew. I think it's very interesting. There's been some interesting surveys on Modi's popularity. And of course, his popularity is in the 60s and 70s and even 80s. Personally, he's very, very popular. He's more popular than the political party that he represents and comes from. So that's in itself terribly interesting, which is possibly one of the reasons why they are projecting him so much, because he can sort of pull more votes than BJP itself can. BJP both as an organization, but also as individual candidates throughout the country. An interesting survey conducted by Pew Research in 2019, I think, so just after demonetization, which was this enormously controversial policy of pulling 100 rupee notes and 500 rupee notes from circulation on a four-hour notice, which badly hurt the economy, in particular sort of local trade and local bazaars. So this was very bad policy, and it probably didn't do any good to the economy overall. It was meant to sort of curb corruption, probably didn't work. The Pew Research survey conducted just months after showed him 88% approval rate. Fabulous. I mean, he was enormously popular even after this horrible economic setback that most people suffered. Now, why was that? Well, first of all, he has got this, he has this image of being someone who wants to do well. So even when he fails, they accept it because at least he tried. So that's one thing. Another thing is that regarding the economy, talking to people locally, really to sort of working class, peasants, etc., people all over the country, you get two messages. One is that economy certainly isn't doing too well. There's a lot of this massive unemployment. There's a lot of frustration about the unemployment, economic growth, etc., locally. So it's a jobless, it's largely a jobless growth. There is a growth, according to some figures, but it's jobless. So people are frustrated by that. However, they tend to blame state governments rather than Modi. So again, he gets away with it, right? So that's terribly interesting. I think that if BJP did not have Modi, they would not be able to get the results there in elections that they are able to. He is an enormous crowd puller. Now, what is it that makes him so popular? Clearly, one thing is that he's a chameleon. He shifts from one election to the other. The message shifts a lot. All political parties in a democracy would shift the message. But in this case, it's the prime minister and his image that shifts. In the first election, 2014, he was very much, as you may remember, the CEO, the Gujarat model. He was called the Vikash Purush, the development man. He was going to bring economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. And even after the election, he did all this international travel. You may remember, you know, he traveled a lot. He met all these business leaders. He went to conventions, et cetera. Now, that stopped at some point. And in 2019, we were all pretty sure that he was going to be hit badly by the poor performance of the economy. And then something happened, a terrorist attack, and he bombed a hillside. Well, he sent bombers to bomb a hillside in Pakistan, crossed the border. And all of a sudden, he was this muscular chowkidar, this guardsman, the protector, the strong leader who you could entrust with national security. And all of a sudden, he was a very different person, right? it wasn't about economy anymore. So the 2019 election was not about the economy. And I think that this, in this election, again, he's turned into a different person. And now he's very much the Hindu man. He opened the temple in Ayodhya on the 22nd of January, which is a huge thing. The temple was built where there used to be a mosque some 30 years ago. It was torn down in 92. But people conceived this not just as, you know, putting down the Muslims for on that particular spot, but undoing 500 years of injustice. So all of a sudden, it's not just, you know, Modi as this prime minister here and now. He becomes a millennial figure, a figure of the ages, someone who really puts India on a new track. All of these figures do somehow live in conjunction with one another, but there's this very marked change in emphasis from one election to the other. I don't know if this is going to be the main message now, but we do see Modi very much as a chameleon who represents a very different image from one election to the other. Now, one thing that needs to be said behind of all of this is, of course, that they have an enormously professional and successful media campaign. It's enormously well-funded. We saw the electoral bonds being revealed just recently, some months back. And there's a lot of money that goes into the political party, and BJP gets the largest sack of money from the electoral bonds. It's billions of dollars worth. How they spend it is not quite clear, but probably a lot of research into this suggests that a lot of it is spent on a massive social media campaigns. If you follow Modi and BJP on social media, it's very professional. You know, they're much more professional than Rahul Gandhi and Congress and the other ones. I follow West Bengal politics. They're not professional at all. It's very primitive, quite unprofessional. Modi's campaign is, you know, it's full of color. It's delicate. It's got music. It's very enthusiastic. It's upbeat. Rahul Gandhi talks to his phone. That's the main, you know, channel of communication. Modi is filmed in all these settings. He's all over the place. And people are cheering, enthusiastic about him. And it's very professional with music, etc. And it's spread by paid, more or less, influencers throughout the country in more or less closed WhatsApp groups. And of course, in open things like Instagram and on Twitter. So, yes, he is a Teflon figure. Nothing sticks to him. And it's partly because there is a very slick and very professional, very successful media campaign behind him.
My own thinking about Modi also often goes back to Tony Blair for the same reason, Teflon Tony. It's as if nothing sticks, no? Rather the reverse, one could say. So charismatic, personalized leadership, strongly professional, organized media campaigning as key ingredients, but still, close to 1 billion voters, no? That's a lot of voters to reach through campaigning and through various forms of mobilizing. No easy task, even for the most charismatic Teflon-like political figure. On the ground, Francesca, in the villages, in the small towns, in the cities, how do parties seek to reach out to and to appeal to this enormous electorate?
That is indeed an enormous task. And we know that political parties in India are generally not strong as organizations. When we think about them in comparative perspectives, Indian parties have traditionally been talked about as very weak, very leadership-centered, few members, no internal democracy, a lot of switching candidates and loyalists who move around so that it's hard to know from one election to the next where you have people. At the same time, when you compare parties, the BJP is much more organized than other ones. Some scholars have suggested that we shouldn't think about political parties in India so much as organizations, but more as vote mobilizing networks. And I think that fits very well how BJP is working. All parties rely on local contacts. Generally, political parties in India do not have party offices below the district level. traditionally, they've been aligned with administrative units, districts, where they could be in contact with the civil service to lobby for things. West Bengal is probably an exception, where the Congress Party used to have offices below the district level, but generally in the rest of the country, there is little evidence of local level presence. So what they do is they work through different types of brokers, community leaders, local level vote mobilizers. And these people can have different profiles. Some of them are in it for ideological reasons, loyalty to the party. Some of them are clearly in it for the money or for the connections. And they indeed have a massive job to do to reach out to voters. So they reach out to voters in their community, in their networks. They organize rallies. They also go door to door to try to mobilize people around election time. The BJP is again known for being much more effective than others in that they have used what they call panna prabharis, one person in charge of a single page in the electoral rolls, where they were in charge of going out to reach out to them. And of course, political leaders, as we just heard from Adil, they matter. Political leaders go around and show face. They drive in and have a rally and show their face. And it's voters often say that a politician bothering to come to their village is hugely influential in who they vote for and also whether they turn out at all. So this kind of contact is really, really important. So you have the personal contact as a really important channel. And compared to other countries, the personal contact, the share of voters who say that someone came to their house to ask for their vote is much higher in India than elsewhere. But at the same time, you need that because you have a large illiterate population, which generally doesn't get news through written sources. And although you have a lot of people, increasingly people online and on social media, it's not everyone. And so, for example, again, the BJP is known to be better than other parties in reaching out to people online. As Adil also said, they're extremely professional. They have very, very high quality data collection on voting patterns and also local level composition of communities. So they target very clearly where they go and what messages they send in different areas. Their social media department is often called the IT cell, and it's known to reach out to a very large number of people very quickly with what they want to get out. So basically, they work through different channels with different messages to different communities. And at the same time, it's important to note that they do not reach everyone. When we look at survey data, surveys are already not reaching the people who are moving around a lot, so migrants, etc. But surveys of people who live in locations do show that a lot of people say that no one actually came to their house to talk to them, that they are never in touch with or hear from parties outside of campaigns at all. And many of them also say that they have not heard of a campaign or politicians at all in any form of media. So there is actually a large chunk of voters who are generally not reached by parties. And that group of people are the ones, if you look at voting patterns, who are the most likely to not turn out on election day, not have be loyal to a single party, jump around. And they are the community that to a large extent seems to be driving the high levels of instability in Indian voting.
So let's look at the opposition. Aril, you mentioned Rahul Gandhi earlier. Aril, last year, Rahul Gandhi and his Congress party and very many other parties entered into an alliance that they call the Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance, or India for short. It's a catchy acronym, but in spite of the catchiness, the alliance has appeared to be increasingly shaky over the past many months and seems to have an increasingly hard time coordinating efforts now that the elections are actually approaching. Aril, with the elections now underway, where does the opposition stand?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a tough one because it's also about how, if they're able to sort of convey to voters a sense of anti-BJP purpose, that might actually attract a lot of votes. But if they convey an image of infighting, that's going to stop people from voting for them. In the last elections, in 2019, BJP got what, 36% of the vote? 37, right? So if they're really, really, really good this time around, they might get a few percentages more, maybe 40%. It still means that 60% of those who actually cast a vote against it. So that's a tremendous figure. I think there are two or three things to note here. One is, of course, that the opposition does not really come together easily without a lot of squabbling, for very good reasons, and that is that they are very different political parties. They represent different interests, classes, perceptions, ideologies, whatever it is. The best example is, of course, from UP, Uttar Pradesh, the largest state up north, in which the two main opposition parties are Sapa and Baspa. Sapa represents sort of lower middle class peasants, landowning groups, and Baspa represents the landless workers. So they have class differences. They also have historically a lot of antagonism, a lot of bickering. They don't easily work together. In West Bengal, there's a long history of antagonism between what might be, you know, possible coalition partners in this, Congress, Trinamool, and CPIM. They've fought against one another for the better part of at least a generation. For them to work together would take a lot of convincing. And also it means convincing local party organizers who have seen the worst side of their opponents in their local constituencies. So I think that there are good reasons why the opposition does come together. So that's one thing. Another thing is, of course, that, as you said, the playing field is not even. The government is using a lot of state apparatus, in particular the police and the legal system, against opposition political leaders, which means that if you get in trouble and you shift away from the India alliance, you may not be in such a lot of trouble anymore. I mean, there are ways of sort of pushing people in different directions. And the mechanisms they use is investigations. All of a sudden, you get a tax raid at your brother's company or something like that. I mean, there are a lot of ways of pushing people in different directions. That's one thing. Another thing is, of course, that often underestimated here is the potential popularity of a lot of things that BJP represents. And it represents these things because it's not in itself just a political party. It's part of a much larger movement, sometimes called the Sangh Parivar, often referred to as an ecosystem. The ecosystem of Hindu nationalist organizations. Some are cultural organizations. They run schools, etc. They do admirable things. Others are militant, activist organizations. Some are criminals. But there's a whole ecosystem of these things. And many of the things that, or the policies that they represent are actually quite popular. So I think that when you, for instance, saw the inauguration of the Ram Temple in Ayodhya in January, that was an immensely popular thing. You know, whether you belong to the opposition or whatever, it was a good thing. A lot of people felt this was right. It was time. And people said, oh, I'm so sorry my father couldn't see this. He would have loved to see that there was finally a temple in that spot in Ayodhya. The changing of the name of the country, also very popular. So there are a lot of these policies are actually quite, they're symbolic policies. They don't really matter for your daily bread, but they are symbolically important. They come not so much from BJP in itself, but it comes from a much larger, broader organization pushing an agenda, a cultural transformation agenda, the agenda of making India into a Hindu nation. And it has a lot of popularity. And I think that it has popularity even for people who belong to the opposition. So it makes it difficult for a lot of activists in the opposition, a lot of party workers in the opposition, and for voters to actively not support BJP.
So let's assume that Modi and the BJP, they win once again, which is what most people predict and also what the opinion polls have indicated for quite some time, that the BJP and their coalition partners may win as much as 400 seats in the House of 543. In the wake of the two earlier wins, 2014-2019, we've seen Modi relatively quickly deliver on some core Hindu nationalist political issues. It's been the abrogation of statehood for Kashmir, as Arild mentioned, the building of a new Ram temple in Ayodhya, the introduction or proposition of new laws that can be used to deport illegal migrants to India with a Muslim background. Francesca and Ariel, if Modi returns to power once again with a strong mandate, perhaps bigger than last time, what can we expect?
Well, they have already announced that they are now implementing the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act, which you just referred to. And we can also expect them to implement the National Register of Citizens that they have talked about implementing for a while now. And the combination of these two policies is what critics worry will be used to deport Muslims who do not have valid papers. And that is the case for many immigrants and also people who have always lived close to border areas and where often it's not entirely clear which country they originally come from. Another thing we might expect is to see the introduction of a nationwide uniform civil code. That's been one of the promises for a while. Right now, several of the communities in India have their own civil code. Goa is the only state actually that has had a common civil code since before independence because they had because of Portuguese colonial history. But now in February, Uttarakhand, which is ruled by BJP, introduced a uniform civil code, and that is now thought to be implemented in the rest of the country too. This is against the will of many outspoken members of the Muslim community, but it's actually likely to be welcomed by feminist groups, including feminist Muslim groups, since it will make polygamy illegal and also introduce an age limit on marriage.
Arild, your...
Yes, right. Predictions? Okay, yeah, so I think that one of the things that's been on the cards for a long while is possible constitutional changes. One thing is, of course, the name of the country. It's been quite frequently over the last year or so, from India to Bharat. Whether that's going to go down well with business interests, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see for that. One nation, one election is another thing that's probably going to come. The expansion of parliament and delimitation of constituencies. They already built a new parliament that seats 888. And there are maps suggesting that there will be a new delimitation of constituencies. And these 888 will be distributed throughout the country in a manner that reflects population sizes, which would actually mean that some of the most pro-BJP states will have a larger say in parliament for the future.
Arin Ingsenrud and Francesca Ingenius, thank you for this analysis of India's national elections 2024 and what they may mean for the future of Indian democracy. The results will be known in early June. The episode was edited by Frode Beckmann and your host was Kenneth Bornelsen. Thank you for joining the Nordic Asia podcast, showcasing Nordic collaboration in studying Asia.
You have been listening to the Nordic Asia podcast.